Okay. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the first ever Litecoin Underground podcast. I am your host, Mega Chunky Buns, along with Why Litecoin. I guess you'd be considered a co-host. Today, we are going to give you guys a little understanding of why we created the Litecoin Underground, where we're heading with it, and also tackle the subject of Bitcoin maximalism. This is episode one, the maximalism fallacy.
Awesome. Yeah.
What's up?
Doing pretty well. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I said in the beginning here, I want to look at what it is that we are working on with Litecoin Underground briefly, get an idea for people who are maybe new to Litecoin at all, and or maybe just have heard us on Twitter. So We created the Litecoin Underground really with the idea of educating some people on how crypto works, maybe even some of the most basic things like creating wallets, and hopefully long-term giving you guys some user-friendly data on creating nodes, mining, even using it at retailers, or if you are a retailer, how do you onboard into Litecoin? But with these podcasts, we really want to dive into some topics a little more deeply. And since this one is on everyone's radar and maybe us Litecoiners are a little sensitive to it, we're going to talk about Bitcoin maximalism. Now, why Litecoin? You seem to have more exposure to it than I do, or you jump into the fire a little more than I do. What, if you wanted to define it, or if you had to define it, what would you call maximalism?
Yeah, I think that's a great question because it's so popular, and it has been since 2014 when Vitalik sort of coined the term maximalism. But I would sort of make these two distinctions between maximalism and then shitcoin awareness. So maximalism is really this public relations effort to discourage the formation of substitutes for any particular coin. It doesn't have to apply to just Bitcoin, although that is the most popular form of maximalism, because they're very known for being toxic and offending other communities, but it also exists in, Ethereum maximalism or Cardano maximalism. You have all of these people who believe so strongly that their coin is so much better and superior to all other chains that they feel the need to constantly promote themselves and bash everything else. So if it's successful, it may benefit existing owners by sort of restricting supply and then elevating the price. But if people are unable to find these close substitutes, activity sort of moves to more distant ones, especially as we've seen, when fees rise. So yeah, I think there's two separate things here, maximalism and then shitcoin awareness. And Bitcoiners often like to promote themselves as the do-gooders, right? They like to say that they're somehow protecting the community, the newcomers, the noobs, by forcing them to buy Bitcoin, right? But I think it's contradictory because they sort of allude to the fact that no other coin could be competitive with their preferred coin. But if that was the case, then there would be no reason to advocate for a single coin, right? Free markets would figure that out.
Well, yeah, it feels like it's illogical to give yourself, if you're going to have 100% of everything in one asset, it almost is a security fault. Like, what, you wouldn't want to do that. You wouldn't ever put all your files on one server, right? It seems you want to have different security protocols in general, particularly for money. But so that's interesting you say that, but it's not necessarily unique to Bitcoin. And that's something that I've noticed too, that, you have your Ethereum maxis, and it's almost some sort of psychological, I don't know, or it's like this gamesmanship, where it feels like people get into the weeds of these weird technical discussions about throughput, gas fees, transaction fees, and there's no real there's no real thought about, like, how is this really impacting people's lives? And in general, when we're when you're talking about massive world adoption of something, we're so far from that, like, to even act as if we have any real clarity of vision about what it's going to look like when you have 8 billion people with the ability to onboard in some fashion, like how they're going to do that and how governments are going to react to this or centralize it or regulate it, license it, whatever there's going to be to it. It's silly to even try to project that far sometimes, right? with any degree of certainty, that's for sure.
That's a good point. Like, people have different needs and values, and you point out that 8 billion people, you know, may prefer different aspects of one coin over another. And I think what's unique to blockchains is that they have to be very specific. Like, the rules are very well defined, and they can't often do multiple things, right? Like, we see coins like Monero or more privacy focused coins make huge trade-offs because they take up way more data in their transaction sizes, so they don't scale as well versus something like Bitcoin or Litecoin. So yeah, you have all of these sort of unique properties of different blockchains that can't all be fit into one. So to sort of assume that everyone will just want the same thing, I think, is naive on the part of any coin maximalist. And then you wanted to get into a couple of other points on that, right?
Yeah, well, so there were really three things, you know, before we got into this that we felt like, I mean, I'm sure there's a number of reasons we could bring up, but three that kind of jumped out of us. One is like what we're talking about right now, we'll dive into, is your free market. People will choose various qualities of a money for various reasons at various times. Also, historically, the second one would be, what is the precedent for having one form of money that covers the earth, so to speak? And then you have some stuff I'd really be interested in on the mining. I'll just say the mining, because that to me is the overall understanding of how the mining fees work today, how they'll work in the future, what the impact of that is on the main chain versus Lightning, on-chain, off-chain, et cetera, et cetera. So first of all, like you're talking about the free market aspect. So I look at this, I guess a good analogy would be if you were to take the aspects of money and say, we have, what are the things people look for in money, right? They may look at the liquidity of it, the fungibility, the cost of transaction, the cost to hold, the legality of it for sure, the user interface, the speed, the decentralization. These would all be different, almost like when you're playing a video game. And now I'm a little older than you, I think, but you know, most video games, they'll have, like, let's say you got 10 characters you can start the game with to choose from. And player one, you know, the first guy might have a lot of power, but he doesn't have a lot of speed. Or one of them's able to use magic, but they don't have any defense, right? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. You have a limited number of points, right? Yeah, to put into all these different characteristics. Gotcha.
Right. So you're always sacrificing one for the other. Like, you can't have decentralization and low cost. That's just it's really difficult to achieve, just like you can't have super security and super speed all at the same time. Like, it's always going to be this trade-off. So that's how I've always looked at it. And I kind of have this whole feeling on the way work, or I guess money works, or energy works in a way too, is you're always having an investment versus a return. So even on your most basic, like, human biological element, like, a animal they may not do in a calculation, but they will decide where is the most return for my effort, right? Burnt calories versus gained calories. And the same thing goes with investments. You know, people are going to look at things like how much effort, how much risk am I taking, and versus what my return is. And situationally, things will be different in different parts of the world. So that's kind of the idea that there'd be one chain that could solve all of that, I think, is I'd have a hard time understanding how anybody would believe that.
Yeah, it just doesn't. Well, it doesn't make any sense in the context of, we already know blockchains are very specific in terms of what they can do. And I think the maximalist would argue that we could do this in higher layers, right? Like Lightning sort of solves privacy issues to some extent. That's what a lot of them would say. And then we can build, you know, smart contracts on things like Stacks. I know the maximalists aren't really a fan of that Stacks protocol. But I think, you know, yeah, like eventually in all these layered solutions, if you want security of the chain, you eventually settle. And I think that ability to do things on layer one is what ultimately secures that niche value of these different blockchains. I don't really buy the concept of, you know, we can just obfuscate everything off of layer one and solve it in the higher layers. I don't, there's a lot of technical points to make about that. I won't go into detail, but I definitely disagree with that argument.
Yeah, well, and even with layer two, like if you know, you and I had mentioned, like let's say you know, Bitcoin is this kind of base layer for a large number of transactions. I think even Lightning or other layer twos could still exist and provide some function, but you're going to sacrifice when you're looking for higher speed, higher tr lower transaction costs. You're going to sacrifice things like decentralization and fungibility. Like it's just there's just no magic elixir to make that happen. But yeah. So the other part we wanted to talk about was kind of the precedent. I guess this kind of ties in, right? So historically, you know, I guess the best example we would probably point to would be the gold standard. That the world, I guess we'll call it maybe the developed world at that point, lived on a gold standard for, I think you may have more knowledge in this than I do. I want to say it was maybe had multiple countries for a total of maybe 100 years or so. Like by
Yeah,
the time everybody got on board to the gold standard, they were off of it pretty quickly, right?
that sounds about right. I think it's about 100 years. I mean, the world sort of used gold as money. There's a 10,000-year history of that. But as soon as, you know, governments started being able to issue their own monies against things like gold and back them with gold, yeah, that's what led to the development of the gold standard. And I actually think it's a fallacy because once you take the money away from the people and issue them this paper that's supposed to be redeemable, you're sort of reliant on the political system to be honest and hold that peg. But, you know, from history, we see that that's generally naive to trust political systems. So don't ever let them put you on a standard. Make sure you got to make sure the people always have, you know, inflation protection by actually using the money and not giving that up. So, but
Well,
yeah.
that's interesting. Like Bitcoin, what I do think is cool about Bitcoin, or probably what draws a lot of people from a, I don't want to call it anti-government, but pro small government faction of the world, is the idea that yeah, you can, people can, hold the money and actually verify the chain independently, right? They can audit at any time. They can choose to essentially audit the Fed. That'd be the best way to look at it, right? That's something we've wanted to do for since the creation of the Fed, is have the ability to audit it, and now we have that opportunity, but only if people actually possess their coins.
Yep, it only works if if people are actually running Bitcoin, like actually possessing their private keys. And I think that's a real problem within, or at least in terms of understanding within the, you know, Bitcoin speculator or HODLer community, you know, people actually do have to possess their coins. We can't really rely on a government. You know, they will talk about hyper Bitcoinization, all these central banks buying Bitcoin, but the moment that people just start trusting, you know, co the Coinbases of the world and all of these exchanges to hold their Bitcoin, you don't really know for sure if they've inflated the supply or not, unless you know, attempt to withdraw your coins. So, yeah, definitely an important point there, in regards to.
Do you think that's going on?
I
Like
think.
just sidebar, do you think there are exchanges that are creating fake coins?
Well, I think it's already been proven that there have been. That's why some of these exchanges have gone down, you know, not maybe the major ones that are still around, but a lot of those early exchanges, like Mt. Gox. I'm not sure exactly what happened there. I don't know the entire history, but
I think that was primarily a hack. But
yeah,
like if we were to
primarily hack,
take
but
because I actually did just yesterday, I was reading, I'm kind of getting a little sidetracked, but I'll come back here. But I was going through Coinbase's legal mumbo jumbo because I was kind of curious. Like, I wonder if they do lend your coins out. You know, like when you use a stockbroker, they can let people short your shares without you're kind of giving them your permission in exchange for these low fees or no fees. And I did read, and they were very explicit that they don't do that, but I would have no idea if like Binance or Bittrex or any of these other people, are they turning around and lending them out at some low rate? Maybe if they're doing it safely, that's okay. But I guess they don't ever anticipate people moving their coins.
Yeah,
And
if you're just constantly seeing an historical trend in more people depositing coins and never taking them off your exchange, you do have the incentive. And I think the important point is whether you know it or not as a user of that exchange, like the potential for them to do it is always there, and they don't really have to ask your permission. And yeah, like I was saying earlier, there were a couple of exchanges. I forgot the name, but sometimes like the founders would just say there was a hack and they'd like secretly run away and like fake their own death. Do you remember that incident?
I know there was a guy in Canada, anytime something dramatic happens on Bitcoin that actually ends up in a real newspaper, my dad will call me up. Hey, did you see this happen? It's like, maybe they could be hacked. Be careful to protect your Bitcoin. I'm like, well, yeah, that's just somebody who forgot their password. Like that, that's not my fault. That's not Bitcoin's problem, right? But it's interesting because I had a thought the other day. I put something out there about it, how these fee structures, and maybe we'll talk about that in your mining part, how the higher fees actually they disincentivize using the coins or even moving them in any way. And keeping fees high gives the opportunity for there to be intermediaries. And third parties do naturally emerge. And so it's been this weird dichotomy that like the high fees actually drive development and they drive these businesses to exist, where if there were no fees, it would be hard to be to profit off of it. So I think some of the low fee chains like Litecoin, and I'm going to say Bitcoin Cash, same thing. I know it just I just equate the two because they have extremely low fees. There's less opportunity to profit off of being an intermediary because they work so well on chain.
Yeah, I think that's
So,
a
go
definitely
ahead.
an important point for sure. Yeah, we can get into this a little bit in more detail, but yeah, once Bitcoin transaction fees go up, you have this urge, or people don't want to pay those high fees if they don't have to. So it does sort of spur innovation on the layer twos, like these exchanges providing, you know, better services to compensate for, you know, the high fees, or they bat start batching transactions, start implementing things like SegWit. Like all these innovations happen because there's demand for Bitcoin users to avoid paying those high fees. But, you know, substitution can happen at the higher layers, like I just described, or it can also happen by just using a new chain, right? Like, again, we were talking about trade-offs. Like the trade-offs for using a layer two exchange is that, yeah, one, you don't actually own your coins, so you don't know if they're inflating your supply. Maybe they're not, maybe they're being honest, but you don't know that. And then the other thing is that I like to bring up often is the political risk that exists. So, like, let's say, hypothetically, in the future, right now, we sort of see the political system trying to, you know, not let anybody send transaction amounts over $10,000 or not withdraw anything more than $600 from their bank accounts, or else, you know, it triggers all these reporting requirements. So I think eventually in the US, these this political system will start to apply the same rules it does to traditional banks to these exchanges. And then, you know, that then it makes it much harder to use those layer twos, right?
Even worse is saying, okay, Strike, you exist in the US, you have to register as a whatever bank, you need a bank license to operate in the US, you need to get one in all 50 states, and start adding all these costs. Everything's got to be AML, KYC, yeah, $600 reporting, and it becomes a bank again. And you get Western Union all of a sudden, it's $4 per transaction because they have costs to cover.
Exactly. Like compliance costs, I saw, are like the number one cost these exchanges are paying. And I think, you know, there's all of this promotion of how Bitcoin solves the problem of, like, you know, interbank transfer fees or wire transfers, you know, being so expensive. But I think we forget that, you know, these compliance costs in the traditional banking world are making it such that, you know, wire transfer fees are so high. If there weren't all these regulatory compliance costs, maybe wire transfer fees would be like a couple bucks instead of 15 or 30 or whatever. And we forget that, you know, those same rules are eventually going to be applied to the Bitcoin white market exchanges too, and in organizations like Strike. So maybe they will eventually have to pass on those costs such that, you know, there's no real value add to their business anymore.
Well, or they'll keep it free, but it'll be quote unquote free, but there'll be a spread. Or
yeah, somewhere
quote unquote free, or they'll be lending out your coins.
Yeah, they'll have to make up that cost somehow. They can't just lose money. So yeah, like it's the same dynamic. Eventually, you know, the sort of market that they're attracting right now, because they can offer the service for cheaper than the traditional banking system, yeah, that may eventually evaporate. And so they're just, you know, stuck in the same boat as Western Union. But we'll see. We'll see. I think it's tough for people to plan for that future because right now, crypto is still new and regulators are still figuring out how to approach this stuff. It is more difficult to track and regulate. And right now it seems like they don't know exactly how to approach it. But eventually, you know, if it becomes as popular as we imagine, then I can't imagine a world where regulators aren't cracking down on a lot of these service providers.
Yeah, I mean, I just see Apple being a Lightning Network node, right? And they're going to be the other part about this that I think is interesting, going back to the maximalism idea, is because it is a free market, people who are going to want to be those service providers and those fee collectors, like Apple, Google, when they start building their own wallets, they could care less who the winner is. You know what I mean? They want to make sure I'm involved in some way and I'm catering my services to as many people as I possibly can, right? Mm-hmm. Within reason. So they don't care if it's Litecoin or Bitcoin or Ethereum or Tron or whatever the heck it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be, they just say, look, I'm here. And that's why I think the same thing, we're seeing it with Coinbase right now. Coinbase has a boggling amount of coins on there now. Like every day, I feel like, what is going on? I keep looking at it. And so they're incentivized to offer services to as many people who are interested. And so why would they want to limit it? And I think that to me seems like such an obvious one. And I would maybe guess that Bitcoiners, this wouldn't be their philosophy, that like no coins will, like no other coins will exist at all. I can't imagine them. Maybe you, like I said, you've talked to them more, but I don't see how they aren't aware that people choose, even if it's illogical, people are going to choose different options.
Yeah, I don't know. It's...
People buy lottery tickets, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so everybody knows it's a horrible investment, and yet people do it, and they do it by the billions of dollars every week.
Yeah, and it's silly because the state is collecting half of the winnings. So yeah,
You're
it's crazy. Yeah,
like,
you
don't
make
get me
two.
started on the states.
Yeah, we could talk about that another time. But yeah, you make a good point there. One is that, businesses don't really care. They care about their profit, their bottom line. They don't have these ideolo they're not going to give up millions and millions of dollars to stick to some ideological purification test of one tribe, right? Like that's what Coinbase does. Like they realize their cost of adding a new coin is almost nothing, and their profit is as many users that want to trade that coin, right? 1% of the volume or something is what they're going to make. And so yeah, I mean, it's almost like it doesn't require any sort of thought. Like, yeah, let's just add this coin. I guess the only thing preventing them from adding coins is like, is this a security or not, right? Like the regulatory risk of that they might run into with the SEC. But besides that, yeah, I mean, it's a no-brainer. And then yeah, as in regards to why these tribal chain maximalists think this way, I don't know. It just, it reminds me a lot of in politics how people just can't see beyond their own inner circle. I don't know. It's just, some sort of cognitive bias there. And I think there's good reason, right? We have historical precedents, and I'll get a little bit deeper into this,
Yeah, it's okay.
is with the gold standard, right? Like I think we like to extrapolate history onto the future. And so I think Bitcoiners look at this monetary world sort of the same as how the previous development of the gold standard happened. And I pointed out a little bit of the fallacy in the idea of a world reserve currency. But I think, the main difference between something like gold and something like Bitcoin is that gold doesn't have costs that increase as the number of users are added. So the thing about gold is, yes, it's not strictly limited in supply. You can always mine more gold. If demand pushes price up, you get more incentive to mine new supply. So the inflation rate can go up if more people demand it. So you kind of get this stable purchasing power over time. But in Bitcoin, there's never any more supply added, right? Because of the difficulty adjustment algorithm.
Right.
And you see all these people that say, oh, yeah, they focus all on supply and say infinity over 21 million, divide the entire universe. In over 21 million, but they forget about the demand constraints, right? Like more people that are transacting in Bitcoin means the price goes up because you have this limited block space that all of these people transacting are competing for. And even when you get into layering up into like layer two and layer three, eventually, right, like you need to be able to settle in order to get the value proposition of Bitcoin. So this fee pressure is inevitable, and that necessitates substitution, like we talked about earlier.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's worth reiterating, we're obviously, I think you and I are both big fans of Bitcoin. I don't think we're trying to say that Bitcoin isn't going to be this premier asset long term that people that will be highly sought after. We're as Litecoiners, I think we would say, hey, we're right next to you, running a very similar protocol, and we just envision a world where there are varied interests and very varied motivations. And so people will choose different monies based on their situation and are, and more than anything, we would prefer a, I would prefer the price of Litecoin to be lower and have more decentralization. I think that's where our aim should be as a crypto community is more power to the people, more ability for users to engage on chain. Regardless of what the coin is, assuming it's a secure chain. And that was actually something else we could talk about in another one is like a defining a true cryptocurrency. Because I think that word gets tossed around so loosely. But go, you know, I think an interesting story is one thing that came up in one of our Twitter spaces last week or the week before. It was I forget the username. I think she went by like Mikasa or something, and she was in the Philippines. And she said that, we were asking, like, well, if people over there, do they use it? Are they aware of it? And she said, like, it's just, it's not even realistic to engage for a lot of people. She said, you know, the average person, someone working at a carryout, makes like $1 an hour US, right? So they're making $2,500 a year. And that's so jarring. And I would say the Philippines is probably considered a developing country. I wouldn't consider them third world. I mean, they have some sort of US relationship, right? Don't we have military bases over there and that type of stuff? So I wouldn't call it, you know, it's not like Honduras. So, but maybe I'm wrong. I could be wrong on that. But just the thought that billions, probably two thirds of the world, lives well below a poverty level that any of us have any comprehension of is, again, that short-sightedness of, do you really imagine these people are going to take their money, even if they're going to use Lightning Network, move it on chain, pay the whatever $10 transaction fee to get it onto the Lightning Network, and then do that once a month or do that however often they have spare cash? Like, it's just, you wouldn't encourage your friend to do it. If it was a good friend of yours, you would say, you know what, man, either you're going to use Strike or something like that, which goes back to the problems we said before, the legality, KYC, decentralization. You sacrifice some of those positives of crypto in order to engage on a second layer, or you find another layer. And I would rather those people learn to use another chain. I'm sorry, another chain instead of another layer. I wish the Bitcoiners would encourage them to use another chain instead of Lightning. And like, the other thing about Bitcoiners too, like, you and I have talked about this, like, will there be, I think what's even more disturbing to me is that it doesn't seem to be voices too much that are willing to stand up and say, guys, this is nuts. You guys are being crazy. Put a third of your coins into the, you know, even if it's, yeah, even if it's 10%, 20%, put some of your coins in cold storage. Like, that doesn't seem to be a loud enough voice. It's about getting returns, leveraging, you know, taking loans out against your Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I mean,
they're just,
you're like, what is happening? And like, I feel like some of the logical voices you hear, like, I know, I follow Eric Voorhees, you know, he's an original Bitcoiner. And I feel like he tries his best, but there's just so much hate that gets thrown his way. I wonder if it's like not worth the battle for a lot of these guys.
Yeah, well, I agree with all the points you made. First, yeah, we're as a community, and I like the Litecoin community especially for this, is it doesn't feel maximalist. Like, yeah, we may promote Litecoin because we think it offers high value for low cost right now, which it does. But at the same time, we're not saying every other coin's a shitcoin. And we definitely promote Bitcoin too. And then, yeah, there's so much silly advice from, and I think it started with Michael Saylor. Once he started getting promoted as this guy, he says some outlandish things sometimes. And I think some of it's just for attention, and he likes creating these crazy metaphors. But the advice of like taking out loans against all of your physical assets and putting it all in Bitcoin is quite insane. I mean, I think that is just the worst advice you could give someone, especially someone that's new and doesn't really know what they're doing. Like, yeah, you may know that the cycle's going to end at like 100K or something, but for someone that is brand new and you're telling them like leverage their house and buy Bitcoin at the top and then they see it drop 80%, like, that you're just destroying someone's life. I think that's totally irresponsible. And I think, you know, unique to the Bitcoin maximalist community is there's this belief, like almost like it's written in the universe that Bitcoin is destined to go up for forever to like $1 million a coin. And so there's like no risk to the downside. It's I don't know. What do you think it is? Because it's, to me, it's still up in the air. It's still really early. There's a lot of variables that could push the price down in the short run. But
yeah, of course, there's always short term things that can, I mean, you could have I think if a Tether bomb exploded, right? If the SEC decided they were going to shut down Tether and freeze whatever assets whatever powers they could do to go in there and say, throw into question, is there really even Tether? Does it really exist? That's what, $70 billion.
Yeah, and, it's a lot.
And that is a little bit of a different discussion, that when people sit here and go, well, $1 trillion market cap, $7 billion is, or $70 billion is only 7%. Like, no, no, no. $70 billion sell off of Bitcoin would have a massive,
massive,
massive impact, right?
I remember, do you remember seeing, this is a tangent, but Tom Lee, do you remember Tom Lee from Fundstrat, the guy that used to go on CNBC all the time?
No, and, I don't know him, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. Anyways, I remember him talking about the multiples of how much, you know, a dollar goes into pushing up the Bitcoin market cap. And it was like a 20X. So like for every $1,000, the Bitcoin market cap would go up 20,000, right? And especially, that's especially true if you have this huge illiquid supply. Like, I don't know if you pay attention to the Willy Wu and Will Clemente on-chain analysts, but I know they talk about illiquid supply all the time. So like if you have this locked up supply, like the majority of coins aren't available for sale, like, yeah, of course, when you like $1 billion comes in, they're competing for such a limited supply, such that it's like a 20 to 25x multiple. $1 billion pushes up the market cap 25 billion. So yeah, and that can be true on the downside too, right? Like if everyone's looking to sell and there's no bid, then I mean, $1 billion could crash the market 50 billion, who knows, right?
Yeah, so I mean, I think in the short term, yes, it goes up, and I mean, I'm sorry, there's always risk in the short term, which I think I played a little bit around with leverage, and I didn't. I fortunately had enough coins that I didn't get liquidated, but I would have gotten liquidated on a 50% loan to value, which would have been just awful, right? Because you're being forced to sell at the very bottom.
Yeah, exactly. But, like,
and it can happen in a flash. It can happen while you're sleeping. Like that's the other part, right? You could just be go to bed one night, wake up, and half your coins are gone, and the price bounces back up.
Yeah,
but I do think like in the long term, I don't think that like, hey, Bitcoin number only go up. I think the actual calculation is that the dollar number only goes down. Like that to me is the inevitability that all assets become more scarce against the dollar as we continue to print and print and print. And that's where I think that where the cold storage hodl, like you can't hurt yourself. Buy it with real money, a beautiful store of value over the course of 10, 20 years. Yeah, you're going to find points where your Bitcoin's going to inevitably grow, just like, and I believe this exact same with Litecoin. I don't think these protocols are going anywhere. As long as the mining keeps mining, they're going to be here. So, but are they going to be $1 million Bitcoin? Maybe. It's hard to believe it won't happen just because we've been on this inevitable freight train. So I do think it does happen eventually.
Yeah, it kind of depends on how the rate of inflation for the US dollar. But if you look at the debt bind we're in and the inevitability, I mean, it's almost impossible to raise interest rates. So I can't imagine. I mean, I could be wrong. There's this dollar milkshake theory out there that, you know, that it may be impossible for the Fed to prevent the rise of the dollar and eventually a debt deflationary collapse. I mean, I don't think that's likely. I think it's more like the dollar's going down and we're going to print ourselves into at least high inflation, if not hyperinflation over the next decade. I could
see a world where the Fed recognizes that if they don't reverse course, that they're doomed and that they choose to actually reverse course, which would be so odd. It would be such a weird thing because it would be actually what we all wanted in the beginning as Bitcoiners.
It would hurt
your stack.
I think it would collapse all markets almost, you know.
Oh,
if interest rates went back to historical norms, like I don't know if you remember or have studied the Paul Volcker era, but in the 1970s, 80s, when there was high inflation, he took interest rates to like, I mean, mortgage rates went up to 18% or something.
Yeah, you want to hear something? My dad had a real estate business, and his business model was, if I don't sell your house in 30 days, I'll buy it. And then Paul Volcker came in. And so housing prices collapsed because, and then nobody wanted to buy a house and won't take out a mortgage. So he ended up having to go out of business. But
Oh man.
he's an entrepreneur, he'll be all right. But no, I mean that was, yeah. I mean, no wonder housing prices are 10 times what they are today. You can borrow
10
at
times as
nothing. I mean,
much,
it's a
yeah.
joke. But so we've gotten a little off track, but I like the conversation. And I think returning back to our maximalism fallacy. So we kind of went over a little bit of the historic and maybe even a little bit of the government reasoning why it would be difficult to see it be the end all be all. You know, the free market kind of keeps creeping in, but I really do want to understand, you've talked about this a couple times in spaces, and maybe I'll probably ask some maybe digging questions a little bit, but you have this kind of idea about how the mining caught the cost of mining. I shouldn't say that. The mining reward today benefits the miners, right? So that's part of their payment. And once the rewards go away, well, fees have to make up
Yeah,
the
so
reward in order to secure the network.
that's 100% correct. So you have this
Well,
level of hash rate.
can we walk through today? Like, can we just say, like, for example, right? Today, a block is mined every 10 minutes, and all the miners in the world are competing for that block, and most of them are in mining pools, meaning they combine their hash power. It's determined who actually contributed to this effort. And so if you have one out of 100 miners, you get 1% of whatever that mining pool wins, essentially. And as far as I can understand, the mining pools will pay you even if they don't win a block, which is kind of weird.
Yeah, I don't I'm not that familiar with how
Have
different
you
mining
mined
pools.
before?
I haven't actually, no, I have not, but we can talk about, yeah, the mining rewards. So 144 blocks, right, I think per day. That's 10, there's one block every 10 minutes. Yeah. So 144 blocks, 6.25 Bitcoin right now in the block reward at a price of, what's today's price? 62,000.
Yeah, here,
So
I'll do the math for you real quick.
yes, we have 62,000 times 6.25 times 144. That gives us a total of about $56 million worth of Bitcoin in block rewards.
Right.
And so if you look at the number of transactions that can actually take place on the chain in a given day, right? Last 24 hours, it was about 240,000 transactions, but we could assume we get up to 400,000. That's about the max that if all blocks are full that you can get through the chain.
How many?
Close to 400,000. So if we take 56 million, did I say 56 or 58?
These are 56.
Okay, divided by the 400,000 transactions, that's an average cost of about, at today's security level, about 140 bucks per transaction. And so my point is that over time, yes, as Bitcoin block rewards decrease and price isn't going up exponentially, forever in terms of real purchasing power, maybe the dollar's just losing value against Bitcoin, but Bitcoin's purchasing power isn't increasing. So there's not like miners speculating on future gains from, higher levels of adoption. We've sort of reached max adoption. The security will have to be paid for through those transaction fees. And right now it's about 140 bucks. So in order to do these high value transactions, you're going to be able, you're going to be forced to pay that $140 transaction fee. And that ties into this idea of, substitute chains, right? Like not all transactions can afford paying that $140 minimum fee level. So anything, and I would argue that.
Well, and you're only really, you're also only substituting the block reward. These miners are also getting fees for each transaction. So let's
Yeah,
say it is
so.
$10. So now you're, I mean, granted, it's a small, on top of that, it's 150 instead of 140. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Yeah. So regardless, yeah, you have this minimum fee level in order to maintain this high security. And, you know, Max was often brag about the high security level, but there is a cost to it. And that inevitably leads to high fee levels and substitution. I mean, I would argue that people are only willing to really pay about 10%, maybe even less, maybe 5% in transaction fees. So if you take a fee level of about $150, at 5% transaction fee, that the minimum transactable amount is about $3,000, right? Like,
right.
5% of 3,000 is 150. So anything between 3,000 and up, you can do on Bitcoin, but anything below that $3,000 level, which arguably there's way more transactions at the lower level than the higher level, right?
Well, even if you could get it to where you're transferring $3,000 and it's 5%, why would you want to pay the 5% still?
No, yeah, I think that's a great point too, because yeah, people won't. If they can avoid it, they will. Like, so maybe the people are only willing to pay 1%. And so yeah, the minimum transactable amount now instead of 3,000 is 10,000 or whatever, 15,000. But yeah, you make a good point. Once you have this future where more chains are monetized, it will be very easy for users, because I think it's just a UI problem. Once you have a wallet that can sort of give you this little slider that allows you to select your security level and your fee, you're going to try to find out, you know, what's the minimum security I need for this transaction, such that it's protected and secure. And I'll just choose that, right? And I'll try to maximize the value to me and minimize my costs. And so that definitely leads to a future in which you have these multiple Bitcoin-like chains, like one through N, like maybe BTC is number one, LTC is number two, and just something else is number three, all the way down the line. But it's tough for me to imagine a scenario where that doesn't happen. So do you have, I mean, I don't know what the Bitcoin maximalists would say to that, but
I will say this, like, I think one thing that's interesting that doesn't get talked about a lot with the security mm-hmm. is that I would probably argue that right now the chain is over secure. Mm-hmm. As crazy as that sounds, like, it's your money. You can't have any fallacy or any fault in your security. But it's almost like if you never have a failure, then it sounds, you don't really know what the appropriate amount of security is.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe what happens over time is that the competition drops to a point of the proper level, like teetering above secure versus unsecure. I don't know. That's part of where it'd be interesting to see. Once block rewards go away, tons of machines are going to get shut off.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no question in my mind.
Yeah, I guess
it still comes down. So then your overall, because the block reward right now is where it is because of how much money, because of the cost of mining. It's very closely tied to the electrical cost. How much is actually invested in mining is very similar to the reward, right? It's a very close balance, I guess. So when the price goes down, machines get shut off, right? Difficulty adjustment drops.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like this stasis level where you're always getting, I'm sure they're making a decent return, the people who are getting electricity at 4 cents a kilowatt hour or something. But ultimately the reward should settle in to what is the true cost to secure that network. Like, you're going to get a super accurate cost of what does it cost to secure this asset at this price?
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense?
No, 100%. Yeah, I think you make a good point. This is a globally competitive market. So I think eventually profit margins do get driven close to zero. And so eventually, yeah, it's going to be demand for the chain, the security level at a certain price. And I don't know the width of like how many transactions I don't know how many chains we'll actually need, is what I'm trying to say. But yeah, you're
Yeah.
going to get just this very specific level of transactability, is my point. Like, you're going to have a range in which it makes sense to pay that fee. But other than that specific range, it won't make sense to use that chain. Is
Well,
do you
goes back,
agree
you
with
know,
that?
I was going to ask this question of you, and I promise this means something. When we were talking about gold, you know, saying it's the world reserve currency, I wonder how many people even owned gold, you
Yeah,
know?
I don't know. My parents didn't own gold. I know my grandparents didn't.
Well, but
I don't think it
I'm
was
talking when it was, you know, we're talking 1870s, right? The world's on the gold standard. Your average citizen, I would imagine 90% of people didn't even use gold at all, right?
Yeah,
They
I
were
think
using
that
whatever their country. Now, if the dollar was tied to gold, I guess technically they would have been using what they believed to be gold.
yeah, exactly. The banks would settle between each other with gold. But I think most people were operating on these bank rails. And so I think that's, again, like that's what the future I think a lot of Bitcoiners imagine, is where most people are just operating on these bank rails or upper layer rails, and nobody's really using the main chain except the banks to settle amongst themselves. But I think the cool thing about Bitcoin is that anyone can do it. So like, it's not prevented by just a government or a bank saying like, yeah, you can't own it. Like, you can always run Bitcoin and accept transactions on chain regardless of what anyone tells you to do. So I think this democratized access is a huge difference between, you know, the gold standard and what the future may look like. But yeah, you're right. Like, nobody, hardly anyone was using gold to settle. Like, nobody was measuring it in commerce in the probably the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Yeah,
They were using banknotes.
so it gets interesting here because when you're talking about the mining, when we get to, and granted, we're talking the rewards, the block rewards will probably be fairly significant through the next 20 plus years, I would think. But just to kind of give you a quick, because I mined for a little bit, I probably had 13 or 14 machines. They make a ton of noise and create a ridiculous amount of heat. And I bought them at the absolute worst time. But essentially, there's a pretty direct calculation about the efficiency of the machines. How much hash power can I create versus how much does my electricity cost? And, you know, you have some loss of energy through like it coming from the street, you know, the electricity, the pipe coming from the street, getting into your computer, you're going to lose a little bit of yield. And then obviously, you're losing a lot through heat and the fan, the cooling, and all that type of stuff. But you could pretty accurately calculate like what's my investment and what's my return, and is very directly correlated to the cost of the electricity. And so I do think that you would reach this kind of level of, like I said, stasis, where these fees are gonna represent the true value of securing that chain.
Yeah.
So what the question becomes is like, why is it so much more expensive to secure Bitcoin versus Litecoin? Ooh, I just hit on something I need a better understanding of.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Fee, ultimately, yes, in the very end, it's the utility, right? The value to the user, and the amount they're willing to pay, to secure their money. That's what's going to drive the price of the chain. And instead of like this speculative behavior that we are like 99.9% is just speculation on the future, making, you know, various different assumptions about what that looks like we've talked about. But your point is spot on. Eventually, it's demand from individuals to transact within this very specific value range, in my opinion, that's going to determine the security level, and not only the security level, the price of the chain, right? Because ultimately, you're paying, like, the price of the chain is going to be reflected in how much energy that chain is consuming and how much hash rate it's providing.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's the single variable that will eventually determine the end price.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because when you think about like the Lightning Network, a second layer essentially is Bitcoiners acknowledging like there will be people who prefer low transaction cost over security or over decentralization. Like they've already acknowledged it, right? With El Salvador, like, hey, this is good enough for them, right? They should be happy to be a part of the Bitcoin revolution in a way. And if they got to use Strike, well, or Shivo wallet, well, that's good enough for them type of attitude. But so they are acknowledging that there's trade-offs, and for some reason they don't want that trade-off to be anybody but Bitcoin. I will say this for your, because you mentioned it, and I do think the shitcoin awareness is probably where most of this is rooted. They just, for some reason, are misguided in saying that everything is a shitcoin.
Yeah, I
And
think.
that might be the biggest hurdle for us to try to, I guess, jump, is to say, listen, guys, yes, there are what are 15,000 coins, 14,900 of them are total just tokens, right? They're like when you go to the arcade when you were a kid, they're just making these things, they're nothing. They only work inside this weird ecosystem. And they don't have any value to the outside world. I would agree to that. And they have no connection between the physical world and the digital world, which is the mining proof of work stuff, right? So maybe that's where it comes from. I think it comes a little bit from like when Satoshi said, you know, if you don't understand it, I don't have time to explain it to you. That seems to be that overall, the big turnoff I have with the maxis is like, hopefully we can do shows like this where you and I are taking the time to talk through the thought process. But if we do this and then we do another one in a year and then people are still harassing us, you're going to go, look, dude, I did a podcast. Go listen to it. I don't have time to explain it to you.
No, I think that's definitely a popular meme, and you touched on a good point. There's a difference between shitcoin awareness and maximalism. I think shitcoins, like they're presumed to be scams, right? Although some of them may have good intentions, they're just sort of ignorant of security principles. But I think the difference between shitcoins and then altcoins, right? Like there may be different implementations of Bitcoin, like Litecoin, that are more secure than others, but these are just like really matters of degree. They're not like so much different, right? Like no Bitcoin is absolutely secure. It's just secure at a certain price, a certain transactability. And Bitcoin started off being not secure at all. It was totally centralized, right? It was the supply was totally centralized. You know, he had to get coins out there somehow, so he decided to do it through this lottery and mining. But really, it started off at super low security, and you couldn't transact much value at all on it, right? But over time, it became decentralized. And so I think it's, you know, hypocritical for Bitcoin maximalists to say that Bitcoin's the only secure chain, it's the only decentralized chain, when in reality, it started out very centralized and not secure at all. And for Bitcoiners to assume that this can't happen again is just very silly, because it happened once. And if fee levels get to, or if adoption levels get to the point that they expect, I don't see why it wouldn't happen again. It is happening again, right? Like with Litecoin, you're seeing more transactions happen on chain, you're seeing more active addresses. So I think it's just this cognitive dissonance. Yes, there's a difference between shitcoining, which is just, you know, a few founders trying to get rich most of the time by pumping something that isn't secure at all, and they're selling it as the next big Bitcoin or next big thing. And that's a lot different than something that like Litecoin, that's, you know, was launched fairly, that's had 100% uptime, is continuously producing blocks, increasing in hash rate, and is there for people to use if they want to use it. There's nothing about it that's scammy. So yeah, there's this very distinct, I think we get in the need to get better at defining these terms when we're talking with Bitcoin maximalists or when we're discussing this as a community, because yes, there's shitcoins, but there's also legitimate altcoins too.
Right. Well, that kind of feeds into like it'd be nice to do one about what are the qualities of a valuable currency. And I think, you know, it is funny. Like, do I think a lot of them are scams intentionally? I don't know. There are some that are obviously built. Yeah, I think I mentioned one last week. My brother was, he dinks around with these altcoins, and he bought one that was, I looked it up on CoinMarketCap, and it was like 10 wallets hold 94% of the coins or something. You're just like, oh my God. But I mean, it's out there. It's a matter of like, do your own research. You could see that if you wanted to,
Exactly.
but
Like buyer
that's not
beware.
advertised, right? It's like, it's not part of their value proposition that, hey, I own. I mean, I can't even, can you even believe, I can't believe Coinbase would even do something like that to its customers of, hey, here's this coin that 10 people own 90% of it. It's just crazy.
Well,
But
nothing
that happens with
surprises me
stocks,
anymore.
though, right? Like you can be an owner of a company and hold 50% of the stock. Like you should, right? If you're
Yeah, and they can always just dilute your shares and issue more, depending on what the management wants to do. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Nothing surprised me about Coinbase. I was really upset with them in 2017 when they started listing like some of their employees, like ICO tokens, and just dumping them. But I mean, at the same time, it's like if do your own research, and if you're going to be buying into these things, like I don't feel that bad if you lose money, because to some extent, there's some sense of individual responsibility that has to be had,
yeah. No. And I think you'll see like over time it gravitates. And it's like, and some people I think know there's risk. Like there's plenty of traders that are like, look, I know this thing is not going to be here, but I don't care. Right now, I'm just trying to catch a wave and end up with more, whatever their preferred currency is, more Bitcoin, more cash, more Litecoin, whatever. So, all right. I think we covered a lot.
Yeah, I think so too. I don't know. This was probably a little disorganized, but we'll get better as time goes on, I'm sure.
Yeah,
But
and I think maybe overall, just remember our idea is that there's going to be many chains. Our focus as a community should be promoting people to learn about what it is, I think, that makes Satoshi's original idea so revolutionary and why it's so important to run your nodes, hold your own coins, enter at your own risk when it comes to other things, and take your time. Like there's, you're not going to miss, like to me, you're not going to miss the boat. If you take your time and you invest and you do your due diligence, you're way ahead of everybody else right now. 99% of the world is still way behind the eight ball in understanding all this stuff.
Yeah, I would add a little bit to that is like, I mean, if you feel the FOMO, just don't go all in. Like you can maybe take a percentage of your net worth and decide, even though your understanding is limited, but put some money in for sure. But as, yeah, you're not gonna miss. It's much better if you miss the boat than putting all your money and getting rug pulled by some scam.
Yeah.
So yeah. Do some research, learn, and yeah, this multi-chain world I think is coming. But if think for yourself, there's obviously so much that we still don't know. And if you disagree, I'd love to hear people disagree with me and why, and ask questions. I'd love to
Yeah,
debate.
so
I'm always
if you do
open.
want, if you get this, we'll probably post it on Twitter. We'll find somewhere to put it, but I'm at LTC Underground is our page. Yeah, shoot challenges to us. Like I do think if we've said something that's inaccurate, let me know. That to me is one of my biggest fears about any sort of public exposing my what's inside of my head is that I try very hard to be. This is just a little personal note here. I very try hard to be very accurate because I feel like that's a representation of me. And I try not to say things unless I've done my research in a way, but there's certainly things I could be misunderstanding. So I want to know it. I don't want to, don't mock me for it. Just tell me where I'm wrong.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm
I'm the
doing my
same
best
way.
out here, right?
Yeah, we're all doing our best, and yeah, we're humans. We make mistakes, but as long as we're aimed at getting the right answers, we're not here to just promote something because it, may benefit our personal net worth. It's about understanding and learning together. So yeah, shoot questions. Hopefully, if anyone listened this far, and then yeah, we're open to discussing any topic that the Litecoin community or anyone, wants to hear.
Yeah, you're at W Litecoin, right?
Yeah, my Twitter profile is at W Litecoin.
And my personal one, I just use me as at LTC Underground. That's probably the best way to reach me. And yeah, we'll try to do more of these, hopefully at least a couple times a month, depending on our schedules. And Wednesdays at 9, I've been doing Twitter Spaces. I'm hoping to have a good one coming up with a special guest soon. So thanks for taking the time. Hit us up with some questions. You got anything else before we go?
I don't. I think that sums it up. Thanks. Thanks for
All right.
anyone that listened. And yeah, check out our Twitter spaces.
All right.